From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. You're listening to Louis Armstrong playing Struttin' with Some Barbecue on today's July 4th edition of Fresh Air. We hear the music and home audio recordings of Louis Armstrong. He made hundreds of tapes and left them in his Queens home, where he lived for nearly 30 years with his wife Lucille. The Armstrong House will open as a museum, probably next year. We'll talk with the director of the Armstrong House and Archives, Michael Cogswell. CTI Records, which recorded soulful pop jazz artists in the 1970s, is reissuing many of its recordings. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews three of them. And Maureen Corrigan reviews the new novel, The Lovely Bones. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Three people are dead and three others wounded following a shooting today at Los Angeles International Airport. FBI spokesman Rich Garcia said authorities are trying to identify the gunman who was killed by a security guard at the ticket counter of Israel's El Al Airlines.
We cannot say anything about the suspect at this point other than we're trying to make a full identification of the person. That one suspect is deceased, and we are trying to make determination on where this person is from.
Garcia said the shooting appeared to be an isolated incident. In addition to the gunman, authorities said a 20-year-old woman and a 46-year-old man were killed. Israeli officials quickly promised to help track down anyone who might be behind the shooting. The comments came as Israel experienced more violence of its own. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
Israeli Foreign Minister Shimon Peres said Israel would offer assistance to the U.S. in pursuing the organizers of the attack. Israelis were quick to describe the shooting as most likely a terrorist attack, although the FBI said they had no evidence as to the identity of the killer or his motives. In the Gaza Strip, a white Mercedes exploded, killing two Palestinians in what Palestinian sources called an Israeli assassination. The dead men were described as members of the Al-Aqsa Brigade. The Israeli army had no comment on the attack. In a further shakeup to the Palestinian security services, West Bank security chief Jibril Rajoub said he would resign at Yasser Arafat's request. Rajoub's status had been in doubt for 2 days. The Gaza police chief also stepped down and said he would challenge Arafat in the coming Palestinian elections. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Jerusalem.
It's been a wet and deadly 4th of July in South Texas. Jim Forsyth reports from San Antonio.
27 inches of rain in 6 days has turned creeks and rivers around San Antonio deadly. Hundreds of people have been evacuated around Canyon Lake, northeast of San Antonio, because water threatens to pour over the dam and inundate the town of New Braunfels. This man was among those who followed the evacuation order.
It saves lives. It's stupid to be out on the lake.
New Braunfels Mayor Adam Cork says it's still uncertain how much damage his town will face.
Well, it depends entirely on how much water comes down through the city of New Braunfels. We expect to see a dramatic increase in the flow through the city.
The bodies of an elderly couple were pulled from their car in a flooded San Antonio Creek today, bringing the death toll from 6 days of flooding to 7. President Bush today declared the region a disaster area. For NPR News, I'm Jim Forsyth in San Antonio.
President Bush began today's 4th of July celebration in the small town of Ripley, West Virginia. The president led the crowd in reciting the Pledge of Allegiance, giving extra emphasis to the phrase "under God," which has been cited as unconstitutional by a federal appeals court. The president also thanked members of the military services. Yesterday, he signed an executive order that grants immediate eligibility for American citizenship to immigrants who are serving on active duty in the military. This is NPR News. The Federal Aviation Administration says today's crash of a small plane in San Dimas, California, appears to be an accident. The crash at a public park left one person dead and 16 injured, including some children who were picnicking with their families. The person killed was an adult. An FAA spokesman said the plane crashed almost immediately after takeoff from a nearby airport. He said the pilot and a passenger on the plane survived. One sad byproduct of the 4th of July celebrations is the number of serious injuries caused by fireworks. Gene Dillard reports on some warnings issued by the nation's eye doctors.
More than 8,500 fireworks-related injuries occur in the U.S. every year. The New Jersey Academy of Ophthalmology says there are over 2,000 eye injuries, with children under age 15 at greatest risk. Academy past president Dr. Peter Nussbaum says the most dangerous are bottle rockets. He says youngsters and adults can be injured by what he calls unguided missiles.
They can suffer injuries to the eye causing scarring of the front part of the eye called the cornea. They can cause detached retinas.
Nussbaum says for children under five, sparklers account for three-fourths of all fireworks injuries. He says they can cause severe burns because their temperature reaches as high as 1,800 degrees, hot enough to melt gold. For NPR News, I'm Gene Dillard in Trenton, New Jersey.
Tennis champions Venus and Serena Williams are once again set to play each other in a Grand Slam final. The Williams sisters both won their matches today in straight sets, moving them into the finals at Wimbledon. Venus beat her younger sister last fall at the U.S. Open, but Serena won last month at the French Open. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs, online at wtgrantfoundation.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
At home in Cronin, Long Island, New York, February 26, 1956. February 6, 1926. I'm sitting up here with Lucille.
She's 1956. Pardon me. That's Louis Armstrong and his wife Lucille on one of the hundreds of home audio recordings made by Louis Armstrong on his reel-to-reel tape machine. Those audio recordings are now part of the Louis Armstrong archives, along with his 5,000 photographs, 350 pages of autobiographical manuscripts, 85 scrapbooks, and 5 trumpets. The archive is based at Queens College. My guest, Michael Cogswell, is the director of the archive and the Louis Armstrong House in Corona, Queens, New York. It's the house Armstrong lived in for about the last 30 years of his life. It's being made into a museum and is expected to open to the public in the fall of 2003. Armstrong celebrated his birthday on July 4th, but according to his baptismal certificate, he was born August 4th, 1901. I spoke with Cogswell during the Armstrong Centennial Celebration. Let's start with some music. This is West End Blues, a classic Armstrong Hot 5 recording from 1928. Michael Cogswell, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Let's start with the Louis Armstrong House, which you direct and which is becoming a museum. Why don't you describe the house and the neighborhood that it's in?
In 1943, Louis and his wife, Lucille, purchased a simple frame house in the working-class neighborhood of Corona, Queens, and they lived there for the rest of their lives. Today, the house is a National Historic Landmark and a New York City landmark, and soon it'll be open as a museum.
Describe the interior of the house and what Armstrong was proudest of.
Well, although it's a very simple frame house, sort of an Archie Bunker house, if you will, they did many remarkable things with the inside. For example, they enclosed the front porch and removed some interior walls to make this gigantic living room, this 70-foot-long living room, which they filled with paintings and upholstered furniture. The downstairs bathroom is covered with mirrors. Every inch of the walls and ceiling is covered with mirrors, and all the fixtures are gold-plated and imported from Italy. So they did many fabulous things with the interior of the house.
Why did the Armstrongs live in a working-class neighborhood for the latter part of Armstrong's life when they could have afforded probably to live anywhere?
Well, it's an interesting issue because Louis, when they bought the house, was already a superstar, and they could have lived almost anywhere, perhaps in Beverly Hills, certainly a big estate on the North Shore of Long Island. Lucille found the house and purchased it and decorated it without Lewis ever having seen it. They were married in 42, and she bought the house in 43. Lewis came in off the road. We know this from his own manuscripts. He gave a cab driver an address, "Take me to this house in Queens." They pulled up front. Lewis said, "Oh, go on, man. Take me to the address I gave you." The driver said, "No, this is it." So he got out, came up, rang the doorbell. Lucille opened the door. "Welcome home, honey." She had a home-cooked meal on the table. She had the whole place decorated. And he fell in love with it and, as we said, lived there for the rest of his life. In later years, Lucille tried to convince him to look at an estate on Long Island and a townhouse in Upper Manhattan, and he refused to even consider them. He was very comfortable there in the neighborhood. He knew the neighbors. They knew him. He would hang out on the front steps of the house and talk to neighbors. He would walk up the street to 106th Street and Northern Boulevard, Joe's Artistic Barber Shop, get his hair cut, chew the fat with the guys in the barber shop. He had a very comfortable life there, and he cherished it. It was a real refuge for him when he was off the road.
An important part of the Lewis Armstrong archives is this huge collection of tapes that he recorded on an old reel-to-reel machine. What kind of things did he record on his reel-to-reel tape machine?
There are more than 650 tapes in the Armstrong collection at the archives. About half of those are simply dubs of LPs and 78s. Lewis would copy his favorite records onto audio tape so that he could listen to them when he was in the hotel room or the dressing room. He had a steamer trunk custom modified to hold his tape decks and turntables, and he used to haul that around with him when he was on the road. You can think of this big getup as like a 1950s Walkman. But he also recorded, the other half of the tapes are spoken word tapes. He would turn his tape recorder on to record when he was hanging out in the dressing room or backstage or wherever. And as a result, we literally have hundreds and hundreds of hours of tape of Lewis and the guys sitting around swapping dirty jokes and band stories, and Lewis and Lucille at home, and you name it.
He also recorded many memories about his life. Who was he speaking to when he did that? Was he doing that for posterity?
That's a good question. Sometimes he would make tapes as spoken word letters. We know from the tape that he was making the tape for an individual, for example, Max Jones, one of his biographers in England. But other tapes, we have to ask ourselves that question, for whom was he making this? And on one level, he's just playing with his tape recorder. He's having fun with his audio equipment. But on another more profound level, he was making it for us. He was leaving an audio legacy for us.
Well, you've brought some tape excerpts with you. Why don't we listen to one of them? And this is a memory of Lewis Armstrong's from his childhood in New Orleans when he came out of the orphan's home. Why don't you summarize what's in this? Because it's just a little bit hard to hear. So I think it would be easier to listen to if we already know what we're listening for.
Mm-hmm. On New Year's Eve, New Year's of 1912, Lewis fired off a pistol in the streets of New Orleans and to celebrate New Year's Eve, and his little buddies were with him. And there was a policeman nearby who saw this. Lewis had been in some minor scrapes with the law before, and he was sentenced to the Colored Waifs Home for Boys in New Orleans. And he spent roughly 18 months there. When he got out, he was released to the custody of his father. Now, Lewis's father had abandoned the family when Lewis was an infant, and he continued to live in New Orleans, but Lewis had had very little contact with him. So the story Lewis is telling is that he's released from the waif's home, and he goes to live with his father and his father's new wife and their children.
Okay, let's hear Lewis Armstrong.
When I came out of the waif's home, when I came out of the waif's home, I stayed a while with my father, Willie, and his other wife and family. He had another wife named Gertrude, a nice woman. She thought quite a bit about me. She liked me pretty good. And I thought she was nice chick, you know. And kind of, I really kind of liked her. She and my father had two boys and a girl, so I stayed with them for a while when I first got out of the Waves home. But I commenced to getting a lonesome, I got lonesome for my mother, Mary Ann. And Mary Ann, you know, that's her nickname. And my sister, Beatrice, who they call Mama Lucy for nickname. And before I realized it, I was back living with them again and happy as could be in that great big room where the three of us were so happily, and we lived there so happily. So very long.
Lewis's mother was a teenage prostitute when she gave birth to him. Did he ever hold that against her, that she had been a prostitute?
Lewis always spoke of his mother with the deepest and most sincere respect and affection. He dearly loved her, and she was a huge influence on his life. It's funny, Lewis occasionally speaks badly of his father. If you stand back a couple of steps, though, and look at the big picture, what is more likely is that his mother was on the street and was hustling, as Lewis would say, and his father left her, and he had a very responsible job. He was superintendent in a turpentine factory, which for a black man in turn-of-the-century New Orleans was a good job, and he held that job for many years, and he remarried and raised children with his second wife. So his father apparently was quite stable. But Lewis worshipped his mother, and he did not have strong feelings for his father.
And he writes in his manuscripts that he always felt very comfortable around prostitutes, and in fact his first wife was a prostitute too.
Well, Lewis grew up in a neighborhood of New Orleans that was so rough it was nicknamed the battlefield, and that's the environment Lewis grew up in, is pimps and prostitutes and street people and nightlife people and gamblers, and he loved them all. He always speaks of his childhood in the most glowing terms of what a wonderful childhood he had. He and his mother and sister lived in a little two-room house with a dirt floor, and there was a privy out back, and they were so poor that occasionally Lewis and his sister would go through garbage to find vegetables, and so they could cut out the rotten parts and eat what was remaining. But in spite of that type of childhood, Lewis always refers to his childhood with great affection.
My guest is Michael Cogswell, director of the Lewis Armstrong House and Archives. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Michael Cogswell, director of the Lewis Armstrong House and Archives. Let's get back to the tape archives that Armstrong left. As you mentioned, he often put his record collection on tape so that he could travel with the tapes and listen to them. Sometimes he'd tape himself playing along with one of his records. And we're going to hear an example of that. And in fact, he's playing along with a record that he was featured on. Describe the story here.
This tape was recorded backstage or in a dressing room because at the very beginning you can hear a trombone warming up in the background. And what Lewis is doing, he spins on his turntable a 78 that he made with King Oliver back in 1923 called Tears. He says 22 on the tape, but we know it's 23. And then he picks up his trumpet and plays along with it. And meanwhile, he's recording the whole thing.
And what was the role that Joe Oliver played in Armstrong's life?
Joe Oliver was one of the great New Orleans trumpet players, a generation older than Lewis, and He took a liking to little Louis and took him under his wing. He became Louis's teacher and mentor. And then King Oliver, well, then he was later called King Oliver when he got to Chicago. He went to Chicago and formed a band there, was very successful, and he sent for Louis Armstrong. So in 1922, Louis left New Orleans and traveled north to Chicago to join the King Oliver Band, and that was a huge step for Louis, to leave his hometown of New Orleans and go to the big city up north, and it really was the launching of his international career.
Before we hear Armstrong playing trumpet with his own recording, let me just read what it is he says, because what he says is a little hard to make out. So remember, he's introducing his recording Tears that he's going to play with, and he says, "Here's one that's a beautiful thing called Tears, and we made that one for the OK recordings, and as this record plays along, I'm going to noodle a little with it, you know, for old time's sake."
You're now about to hear some of the finest incidents that'll take you way back as far as the year of 1922, when I, Lou Armstrong, was playing second trumpet with Joe Oliver at Lincoln Garden in Chicago. And also used to write a lot of tunes. Here's one that's a beautiful thing called Tears, and we made that one for the OK Recordings. And as this record play along, I think I'm gonna noodle a little with it, you know, for old time's sake. Show you how the trend of recordings and everything has changed. But you'll get a good idea of this record. It's a pretty thing.
Louis Armstrong from one of the recordings that he made himself with his reel-to-reel machine. My guest Michael Cogswell is the director of the Armstrong House and Archives. How are you dating the tapes that Armstrong recorded?
As a rule, the only way that we can date these tapes is by references on the tape to a current event or recording session or some other indication of when Louis made the tape. We can look at the manufacturer of the tape, the type of tape it is, and get some evidence that way. But really, Louis's references on the tape are the only hard evidence we have of when he recorded it.
Armstrong also left a lot of journals. And you have those journals in the Armstrong House and Archives. Let me read you something that he said in one of his journals. And the Jewish family he's referring to here is the Karnofsky family, who we can talk about in a moment. But he says, "Many kids suffered with hunger because their fathers could have done some honest work for a change. No, they would not do that. It would be too much like right. They'd rather lazy around and gamble, etc. If it wasn't for the nice Jewish people, we would have starved many times. I will love the Jewish people all of my life. The Negroes always wanted pity. They did that in place of going to work. The Negroes always hated the Jewish people, who never harmed anybody, but they stuck together. And by doing that, they had success. Negroes never did stick together, and they never will. They hold too much malice, jealousy, deep down in their heart, for the few Negroes who try." Is that the kind of thing he would have said in public, criticizing African Americans like that?
He would have. We have to put that particular manuscript in context. It's a very powerful passage, and I'm not going to back off and say Louis didn't mean it. He obviously did. But he wrote that manuscript, and he opens the manuscript by saying this. He is ill in his bed at Beth Israel Hospital. This is about 1969, and he is critically ill. He's in Beth Israel Hospital. So he's not feeling well. He's facing his own mortality. Plus, as he started that manuscript, before that passage that you read, Joe Glazer, his manager from 1935 on, they had made each other rich and famous. Joe Glazer had a stroke, was admitted to the same hospital, and was in a coma just a couple of floors below Lewis. The kindness of Jewish people to Lewis during his lifetime is also a factor in that manuscript. The Karnofskys were a family of Russian Jewish immigrants in New Orleans who took Lewis under their wing and really helped him, took a keen interest in him. Joe Glazer, who we said was critically ill in the hospital, and Lewis's personal physician in Beth Israel Hospital, who was tending to him at that time, was Dr. Gary Zucker. So it's a very difficult time in Lewis's life. In addition to that, we have to put it into the context of the 1960s. With the riots and the civil unrest and the assassinations. And so I think all those factors go together to make a context for that passage. That passage does display a bitterness that you don't see in any of Armstrong's other writings or tapes.
Armstrong did have some pretty powerful things to say during the civil rights movement. What are some of the statements he made?
Perhaps the most famous one is when the Little Rock crisis was unfolding. Lewis was out in the boondocks, I think North Dakota, and a local reporter knocked on his door to interview the famous Mr. Armstrong, who's in town. Lewis at that time was watching the television news broadcast about Little Rock, and he let loose with both barrels. He said that President Eisenhower was two-faced and had no guts. He called Governor Orville Faubus an uneducated plowboy. He said, the way they're treating my people in the South, the government can go to hell. The reporter wrote this up, took it back to his editor. The editor knew exactly what he had and showed it to Lewis, and Lewis approved it, wrote solid at the bottom of the sheet. It got published, it got picked up by the Associated Press, and went out all over the world. So that's the most famous statement Lewis made about civil rights. But in his dressing room tapes and in his manuscripts, you can tell that Lewis, as a rule, felt that he could do more for the civil rights struggle by being Lewis Armstrong, by performing, by knowing his fans, by traveling around the world. And that's the tact he took.
Michael Cogswell is the director of the Lewis Armstrong House and Archives. Cogswell will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
It was just one of those things, just one of those craziest flings, one of those bells that now and then rings, just one of those things. It was just one of those nights, just one of those fabulous.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Saving Your Brain, the revolutionary plan to boost brain power, improve memory, and protect yourself against aging and Alzheimer's by Jeff Victoroff, M.D. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We're listening to the Lewis Armstrong recording Fireworks. Coming up, we continue our conversation with Michael Cogswell, director of the Armstrong House and Archives. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews three CDs from the 70s that are part of the CTI label's reissue series. And Maureen Corrigan reviews the new novel, The Lovely Bones. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Michael Coxwell, the director of the Louis Armstrong House and Archives, the house which Armstrong lived in with his wife Lucille for about the last 30 years of his life, is being made into a museum, which is expected to open in the fall of 2003. The house is in Corona, Queens, New York. The Armstrong Archives, located on the Queens College campus, is already open. It includes the hundreds of home audio recordings he made and his autobiographical manuscripts. When we left off, we were talking about what Armstrong had written on race and politics. He also wrote about, you know, his pleasures in his journals, and one of the pleasures that he wrote about was smoking marijuana, which he did from the age of 26 on, and when he started smoking, there weren't any laws against it. He wrote, "It puzzles me to see marijuana connected with narcotics, dope and all that kind of crap. It's actually a shame." He also said that marijuana was 1,000 times better than whiskey. "It's an assistant, a friend, a nice cheap drunk, if you want to call it that. Good for asthma, relaxes your nerves." What else did he have to say about marijuana?
Well, it's true. He was a lifelong pot smoker, and having said that, Louis was also the consummate professional. He was always on time and ready to play, and one of the most creative people of this century or any other century. He would speak about his pot smoking in his writings and in the tapes, you know, just in casual references. It was no secret that he smoked marijuana. I think one of the most amusing things that comes to mind, there was a biography of Armstrong published that mentioned in passing that Mez Mezro did arrangements for the Louis Armstrong Orchestra in the 30s. And I and other people read that and said, gee, that doesn't sound right. I mean, Mez Mezro was a part-time clarinet player, but he didn't have the technical facility to do arrangements for a big band. Where on earth did that come from? Well, a couple of years ago, we acquired a copy of an Armstrong letter from the Library of Congress, a letter that Louis wrote to Mez Mezro in the 1930s. And he says, in essence, "Dear Mez, we're doing a tour of Europe, and I need some arrangements." Now, you have to understand that Mez Mezro was Louis Armstrong's pot dealer. He says, "Mez, I need some arrangements. I need enough arrangements to last 6 weeks, and I need some really good arrangements, and I'm wiring the money to the American Express office in Paris, and you dig, Daddy, I know you'll understand." So apparently the biographer had seen this letter and not really understood what Louis was saying.
One of Armstrong's big hits in the mid-50s was Mack the Knife, which is, you know, the Kurt Weill Bertolt Brecht song from the Three Penny Opera. And with Armstrong, it became this big pop hit. There's a recording that he made with Lottie Lenya of the song, and Lenya, by this time, was the widow of Kurt Weill. And she, of course, was in the original production of Three Penny Opera. Her style of singing is much more of a theater music style, not the kind of behind-the-beat jazz style of Armstrong. And on this recording, it seems to be Armstrong's session, and he's coaching her in the kind of rhythm that he wants. And I think it's really fascinating to listen to him control the session and coach Lenya. So I thought we could give this a listen. Anything you want to say about this track?
Well, we have tapes of this in the Armstrong Archives. It is fascinating. Lotta Lenya has come by this recording session, and Louis is coaching her on the coda, on the tag, to Mack the Knife, and she just can't get that final syncopation. And Louis is so gracious and so patient with her. It's really a great example of these two together.
So here's Armstrong and Lenya, recorded in 1955, just a few months after he recorded his hit, Mack the Knife.
Look at your Suki Tadri.
Jenny Diver.
Look at your Lottie Lenya.
So sweet Lucy Brown.
Oh, the line forms on the right deals.
Now that Mackie's back in town.
That's all right. All you gotta do is we straighten it. Now that Mackie's boom, back in town. And we'll pick up from there. Now we're straight now.
Good.
See, like this. Down, down, down. See, Mackie's.
That's easy for you.
It's like a phrase.
Now that Mackie's.
No, make it 8 notes. Get Mackie's. Boom. Back in town.
Good.
Back in, one, yeah. Two, three. Yeah. The longer speed is up, you know.
Now that Mackie, back in.
No? That's where if you stay it fast, it's still straight. See, because yeah. I'm going to start blowing right over here. Yeah. Not that Mackie's, boom. Back in town, one, two, three.
Yeah.
That's it. Now we go right from the vocal, come on.
Okay. Where you starting from?
Right from the clarinet break.
Tell me what he's doing.
Okay, vocal only.
Oh, the shark has. Well, no, let him make it. Why don't you just start right on the clarinet break? You let know that we're straight up.
Okay, Suki Tawdry.
Now that Mac heats, boom.
Suki Tawdry, take two.
All the way. Yeah,
just Suki Tawdry.
Oh, the singing. Suki Tawdry.
Jenny Diver.
Lottie Lanier.
Oh, sweet Lucy Brown.
Girl, the line forms on the right ear.
Now that Mackie's back in town.
Louis Armstrong and Lottie Lanier recorded in 1955. My guest is Michael Cogswell, director of the Louis Armstrong House and Archives.
I want to hear another of the tapes that you brought with you from the archive. Again, this is another tape that Armstrong made himself on his reel-to-reel recording machine. And in this, he's talking about the movie High Society, which he made with Bing Crosby and Frank Sinatra. And Armstrong plays himself in the movie. He's performing for this, you know, big, expensive wedding and the wedding party. Tell us a little bit about the context of this tape we're going to hear.
Lewis has just finished making the motion picture High Society. He was very proud of it. Frank Sinatra, Bing Crosby, Grace Kelly, and so forth. And he really Lewis has a really featured role in the motion picture. And he's making a tape to tell somebody, I think his manager, Joe Glazer, about making the picture High Society. And he begins to describe the opening scene of High Society, which features the whole band in a bus traveling up to Newport.
Let's hear it.
Now, for the picture, it's just made for us because we open it up with a bus scene. It's a satire on this jazz festival up in Newport. And it seems as though we are in this bus going up there to play this festival. And as we go up that road among those fine homes, you know what I mean? And that's when I start telling the boys, just dig that scenery fast floating by, see? We're now approaching Newport, Rhode Island. We've been for years in variety, but Charlie Knickerbocker, now we going to be in high society. You know, that's one of the things. We're singing among ourselves. That's in the beginning of the picture, and you're talking about bunch of cats, and you know your boys out here can ham up a thing. And they're all trying to steal that scene. Trouble young mugs so much, folks, I'm telling you. Tell you, even when the director was explaining the scene, he was mugging, listening.
That's Louis Armstrong in one of his own home recordings, talking about the movie High Society. My guest, Michael Cogswell, is the director of the Armstrong House and Archives. It must be an incredible job to oversee thousands of reel-to-reel tapes, plus recordings and books and manuscripts. What's it been like for you in the past few years to go through all of this and discover what's in the manuscripts and what's on the tapes?
Well, I was in a very interesting and a very privileged position. I was hired in 1991 to arrange, preserve, and catalog Louis Armstrong stuff, which had been taken by Queens College from the house and brought to a state-of-the-art archival center on the campus of Queens College. My first day at work was in July 1991, and I walked in to find 72 cartons of materials stacked up willy-nilly, and I had to borrow a pad of paper and a pencil to begin work. And so we really started from ground zero, and it's just been fascinating because you never knew what you were going to find when you opened the next box. Now, 10 years later, thanks to financial support from the Louis Armstrong Educational Foundation and the Save America's Treasures Program, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and many others, the funding has been provided, the staff has been hired, the equipment has been purchased, and things are going full steam ahead out there in Queens.
Do you have a favorite discovery, a moment that was a particularly big oh wow moment for you?
Well, the tape recordings have provided a number of those moments. Louis playing along with Tears was one of them. There is one home recorded tape, which I didn't bring today, in which Louis and Lucille and a friend are having a discussion in Louis's den, and then the friend leaves to go to work. It's late at night. I think he's a musician. And then Louis and Lucille get into a little marital spat, you know, an old married couple talking about some of their issues. And then Lucille goes to bed, and you can hear Louis walk over to the bar in his den and put some ice in the glass and pour himself a drink and sit in the chair and sip on the drink and rattle the ice and cough and sip on the drink. And that goes on until the tape runs out. So I was the person who originally copied that tape, and never have I felt like such a voyeur until that tape.
Well, Michael Cogswell, good luck with your work with the Armstrong House and Archives. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thanks for your interest.
Michael Cogswell recorded last summer. Cogswell is the director of the Louis Armstrong House and Archives. The house in Corona, Queens, is being turned into a museum that is expected to open late next year. The archive on the Queens College campus is already open. The current exhibit is called On the Road, Armstrong's International Tours. A new exhibit on his record collection opens July 29th. Here's Louis Armstrong, recorded in 1951.
Give me a kiss to build a dream on, and my imagination will thrive upon that kiss. Sweetheart, I ask no more than this, a kiss to build a dream on. Give me a kiss before you leave me, and my imagination will feed my hungry heart. Leave me one thing before we part, a kiss to build a dream on. When I'm alone with my fancies, I'll be with you, weaving romances, making believe they're true. Oh, give me your lips for just a moment, and my imagination will make that moment live. Give me what you alone can give, a kiss to build a dream on.
Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews new reissues from the 70s on the CTI label. This is Fresh Air. For some jazz fans, the 1970s will always be the pits. Many veteran players were idle, the controversial avant-garde was thriving, and loud jazz rock fusion was on the rise. Jazz record sales were down, but one new label did find success. CTI Records successfully championed soulful pop jazz artists like guitarist George Benson, flutist Hubert Laws, and saxophonist Grover Washington and Stanley Turrentine. A massive CTI reissue program is underway. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead takes a look.
Organist Johnny Hammond, 1971, on Neil Sedaka's Working on a Groovy Thing. Jazz musicians have often looked to pop music for material, for reasons usually including a desire to cross over to a larger audience. In the 70s, the king of jazz crossover was producer Creed Taylor, whose labels CTI and Kudu flourished just when mainstream jazz was on the ropes. CTI's slick LPs, whose glossy covers look more like upscale magazines and album art, appealed to many members of the black middle class most jazz musicians would love to connect with. But for some jazz fans, CTI was part of the problem. The jazz content was a bit watered down and the courting of a mass audience a little too blatant. Neil Sedaka, come on. But at CTI, crossover went way beyond current pop, taking in Bach's Brandenburg Concertos, the Strauss Fanfare from 2001, and a little symphonic Gershwin from Argentine keyboardist Amir Diodato. Hubert Laws' take on Stravinsky's Rite of Spring was kitsch, but Laws was no match for Diodato. His funky classics paved the way for Walter Murphy's disco hit, The Fifth of Beethoven. Imagine having that on your conscience. Rhapsody in Blue from Deodato II, where he also favors us with the Moody Blues' Nights in White Satin. It's one of 15 CTI albums getting re-released on CD this season, some with bonus tracks to fill out the skimpy playing times. I confess I was a bit snooty about this stuff when it was new and look forward to hearing it again, but a lot of what struck me as dopey then seems no better now. Even a great musician like vibist Milt Jackson could get stuck in a sugar-glazed surface. But some marketing decisions did pay off. Trumpeter Freddie Hubbard from his good CD, Red Clay. Like any efficient corporation, CTI identified and filled a hole in the market. In the early 70s, many Miles Davis fans took their hero's new loud funk as a personal insult. So CTI went back to what Miles sounded like just before he freaked out, when his music had only light funk trappings like a catchy bass vamp or punchy electric piano. Three Miles veterans, pianist Herbie Hancock, bassist Ron Carter, and drummer Jack DeJohnette got tapped in various combinations to spike a few CTI sessions and gave him an edgy quality that was all wrong for elevators. On Red Clay, Hancock, Carter, and drummer Lenny White bring back a whiff of 1968 Miles, but Hubbard's brasher trumpet keeps him from sounding like a copycat. We'll be right back. The CD of Red Clay also has Hubbard's take on John Lennon's Cold Turkey, which went unreleased till now. CTI's attempts to make jazz out of rock didn't work much better than most, but they've lasted longer. Hip-hop artists have been sampling those LPs for what seems like forever, putting those old-style grooves back before the public ear. Makes you wonder why a lot of these oldies are only getting re-released now.
Kevin Whitehead writes for the Chicago Reader and the Chicago Sun-Times. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews the new novel, The Lovely Bones. This is Fresh Air. Siebold is the author of the memoir Lucky and has been named by the Village Voice as a writer on the verge. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says that with her first novel, The Lovely Bones, Siebold is no longer on the verge. She's arrived and triumphed.
The first 15 pages of Alice Siebold's astounding debut novel, The Lovely Bones, were honestly almost impossible for me to read. And the rest of her novel was almost impossible for me to put down. I've never read a novel quite like this, and if it hadn't been for the fact that it was a reviewing assignment, I wouldn't have even picked up The Lovely Bones. This is a story narrated from heaven by an adolescent girl, a girl who's been raped and murdered by a serial killer. In those aforementioned first 15 pages, we readers witness that act. The torture and death of a child probably tops the list of subjects I don't want to read about. But because I was required to, I ended up having a singular, disturbing, and even enlightening literary experience. Like other great but horrifying works of art, The Lovely Bones is its own justification for being. Our narrator's name is Susie Salmon. In 1973, when she was murdered, she was 14 years old. Her murderer, we readers know, was a neighbor named Mr. Harvey. A weird guy, but not glaringly so. He lived by himself a few houses down from Susie's family in a suburban development outside of Philadelphia. About that opening murder scene, I'll just say that it was in no way salacious, and that as a reader, it's not like I got over it during the course of the novel. Instead, I learned to live with it as a constant waking nightmare, just as Susie and her parents and brother and sister do in a more bewildered way. Susie's family, perhaps mercifully, never learns exactly what happened to her. Some blood and other awful physical evidence is found in a nearby cornfield, and years afterwards, a charm from Susie's charm bracelet is found next to the body of another murdered girl. Susie recollects her violent death and watches over her grieving family from a place she calls My Heaven. And part of the brilliance of this novel is the way Siebold animates her unsentimental spiritual landscape. It's a place where one's simple wishes are granted. Susie's heaven looks like her junior high school campus, and there are lots of dogs there, too, because she's a pet lover. She's looked after by a matter-of-fact counselor named Franny, and she learns, among other things, that heaven has elements of black humor. One of the most popular games that residents of Heaven play is called How to Commit the Perfect Murder. It's a game they excel at because so many of them were victims. But heaven, or more precisely this kind of way station to heaven with a capital H, doesn't grant its residents their most profound wish, to be alive again and back with the people they love. At one point, Susie asks Franny how to be released from her tormenting yearnings, how to reach the more traditional heaven where I would feel only joy and have no memory, no cornfield, and no grave. Franny tells Susie that if you stop asking why you were killed instead of someone else, stop investigating the vacuum left by your loss, stop wondering what everyone on Earth is feeling, you can be free. Simply put, you have to give up on Earth. Meanwhile, back on chaotic Earth, Susie's teenaged friends and her family struggle to let go of the hope of ever seeing her alive again. Her 4-year-old brother is still blessedly oblivious, while her mother finds, as Susie compassionately puts it, a doorway out of her ruined heart in merciful adultery. Susie's younger sister, Lindsay, must bear the burden of what Susie calls the walking dead syndrome, meaning that everyone sees Susie, the murdered sister, superimposed on Lindsay's face. Their father is the ordinary hero of this story, constant in his vigil, always talking to Susie, scheming to entrap the man he suspects murdered her, even as he himself becomes a nuisance in the eyes of the police. In a breathless scene towards the midpoint of the book, Lindsay risks her own life to find some small measure of vindication for her father. A day or so after finishing The Lovely Bones, I became aware that, unconsciously, I had put it face down in the middle of a pile of otherwise undistinguished new books. That's the kind of power this novel radiates. It needs to be muffled, quarantined. Otherwise, Susie's questioning voice overwhelms all the reassuring noise of everyday life.
Marian Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Lovely Bones by Alice Sebald. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. Our engineer is Al Banks. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
It's very clear. Our love is here to stay.
On the next Fresh Air, we remember Rosemary Clooney with a concert and interview we recorded in 1997. Clooney died Saturday at the age of 74. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air. The rain.